Okay, the Commission on Equitable Housing and Development meeting is now commenced. It is June 2nd at 4 p.m. This meeting is being held virtually due to COVID-19 to allow for social distancing and protect the public health. As we continue our efforts in meeting remotely, we ask all commissioners and guests to mute yourselves until called upon to speak to avoid feedback and background noise. For those who have dialed in using a call-in number, to unmute to speak, dial *6 on your phone. Also, prior to speaking, please announce who you are to identify yourself. As a reminder, this meeting is being recorded. We ask that you only use the chat function to request to speak or to announce that you're leaving meeting so we can track quorum. Also, in order to comply with the state open meeting law, attendance and votes will be done by way of roll call using audio, not via the chat function. We're going to do roll call. Michael Edmonds.
I am present.
Olga Flores is absent. Sharia Jimenez.
Present.
Jim Toffel, I am present. Liz Wilson.
I'm here.
Jay Young.
Here.
Mindy Bernstein is absent. Lori Mazurbo.
Present.
And Ken Brianna Washington.
Present.
Okay. How are you, Ken Brianna? Okay, our ex officio members are Maggie Amato-Tayez. Is Maggie? Maggie's not here. Okay. Wendy Asher.
Present, and I'm going to be leaving at 5, just so you know that.
Okay. Thanks, Wendy. Mm-hmm. Marianne, I believe, is absent. She's on vacation this week. Mark Clark.
Yo.
Vicky Casino.
I'm here.
Marcos Isbell.
I'm here.
Betty Villegas.
Here.
Hey, Betty. Corin Manning.
Present.
And Liz Morales.
I'm here.
Okay. So a second agenda item is to review the adoption of the May 5th meeting minutes. Those minutes were not posted onto our website. We're going to have to postpone that agenda item to next month. Our third agenda item is the call to audience. This is a time when any member of the public may address the Commission on Equitable Housing and Development. Due to time constraints, the total time allocated for this is 15 minutes. Individuals are allowed 3 minutes each. Due to open meeting law, commission members cannot discuss topics that are not on the agenda. Items brought up by the public may be considered as an agenda item for future meetings. Is there anyone who'd like to speak? Joe.
Thanks, Joe Adino, Barrio Central resident, Barrio Neighborhood Coalition. Treasurer and Board of Historic Fourth Avenue Coalition. I was just talking with somebody the other day kind of about the history of this commission, and I remembered that it was 3 years ago this month, June of 2019, that the mayor and council asked the city manager for an anti-displacement task force, and of course that evolved to become the Commission on Equitable Housing and Development. And I hope everybody can reflect on what's happened over the last 3 years and what this group is doing and whether we think we're making progress. And I know that a couple of our subcommittees didn't even have a chance to meet this month. So I hope there is kind of reflection on that and recommitment to the great task that is in front of us with regards to housing in Tucson. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. Anyone else would like to speak? Okay. We're going to move to the next agenda item. I don't know. I don't think we need to put this to vote, but I guess without objection, I would like to make two agenda item changes. The first is we'd like to move Laurice Walker, who's with the City of Tucson Equity Office, to agenda item number four. And then agenda item number four will become agenda item number five. And then Liz has a conflict at 6 o'clock, so she asked if we could have the HCD updates occur before the subcommittee updates. So does anyone object to making those couple of changes to the agenda? Okay, hearing no objection, then we're gonna go ahead and make those adjustments. So agenda item number five, which is we're moving up to number four, is Laurice Walker. Laurice, thank you for joining us today. Laurice is with the City of Tucson Equity Office. She's how long have you been with the city now?
Good evening. I've been with the city for about 2 months now. 2 months and maybe a week or so. So it's been exciting. Thank you all for having me.
You bet. So go ahead, you've got the floor. And I would like to hear about what you're doing.
Yes, so one, I apologize in advance. I am a little under the weather, so if my voice is raspy, that is why. But yes, I don't necessarily have a formal presentation. I've been with the city for about 2 months now. I come from Minneapolis. Before I came to Tucson, I was with the City of Plymouth as their Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Manager. And then prior to that, I was with the City of Minneapolis Division of Race and Equity. So I've been in DEI or race equity work for about 10 years. I focus on organizational psychology. So I spend a lot of time focusing on individual behavior change as it pertains to race equity, diversity, and inclusion. My goals here are what I've been tasked with the City of Tucson is to establish their first equity office. So this is my third inaugural office. I've worked in this work and new offices for the third time with this coming to Tucson. So I'm super excited to have skills and assets that I plan to bring from other agencies that I've worked with to bring to Tucson. With that, we'll be having four employees that will work or report under me. So we'll have two program managers. And those applications just closed yesterday, or no, today's Thursday. So those closed on Monday. And, you know, that'll be for a data analyst, an equity engagement manager, and then we'll have an executive assistant and then a program assistant as well. So those will be the four positions that will be reporting to me. And essentially what our work will do is to focus on, you know, how are we going to support the City of Tucson and all departments looking at their policies, their practices, and their programs through an equitable lens to make sure that accessibility for all city residents are being accessible and people have access to services in an equitable way. So that's really in short what we are trying to do, what we're charged to do. I have a 90-day plan that I've been working on, and a part of that has been getting to know the different departments, the directors, the managers, the supervisors, as well as the professional staff in the organization. But then also looking at, you know, what our elected officials and council members are working on when it comes to equity, and then also working with some community organizations. And so far, this has been community organizations reaching out. I do have plans to continue to support boards and commissions as well. In my previous roles, I've staffed two boards and commissions, so making sure that they know what their roles and responsibilities are as it pertains to advancing equity and whichever municipality that they're in. So I can stand for questions if there's questions.
Does anybody have a question for Laurice? Liz.
Hi, thank you so much, Laurice, for telling us about this. So I'm curious, are you going to be looking at programs within the city? And I know you said that you're looking at, or you're currently working on a 90-day plan. So do you have any sort of priorities regarding which programs you're going to apply that equity lens to?
So at this moment, we don't necessarily have any priorities because, again, I'm still getting that bandwidth of like what has already happened in the city. And what I'm trying to do right now is shift the organization into thinking that the organization has been doing equity work in some capacity. It just might not have been titled that. So really what I've been doing in my 90-day plans is really that gathering information data, and then I will propose my recommendations. Right now, I do know from one of the expectations upon interviewing was about looking at how we spend our budget and various things like that. So I think that that will be kind of one of those top few priorities, but also simultaneously working with organizational culture and messaging and how we understand what equity means for the city, and then also community engagement. But with this being a very new office, we're definitely open and open to ideas, open on to what our expectations are. So if there's anything that you know of, or the community or other folks know what's a priority, making sure that that's given to us will be helpful.
Jay?
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us, and welcome to Tucson. I guess I have maybe two questions. They might kind of be the same, but I guess what I'm hearing and what I'm maybe wanting clarification on or better understanding is, I guess what I'm kind of hearing you talk about is more kind of internal in terms of the city bureaucracy and how different departments are working internally and looking at equity, and which is great. But, you know, I think I'm just wondering, you know, obviously as a commission for equitable housing and development, we're really looking in a lot of ways, I'd say, more externally, right? Like, how is Tucson equitable or not, particularly in the housing space? So I'm wondering if your department is going to be looking externally at how equitable or not Tucson is. And then I guess my follow-up or part of that is, how are y'all going to measure equity? Which I know is a big question, but I'm gonna put it out there.
Yes, so for now I can tell you, Jay, that I will have an update pretty soon on how we're gonna measure equity, because that is one of those big things, right? It's not work that happens overnight. It's definitely thinking about that transformative work that's gonna lead to sustainability. But when you talk about external work, right? So we did hire for a program assistant to focus on community engagement and public participation, right? Because we do want to hear externally, and that position's external facing. A lot of their work will be working with different boards and commissions. It'll be working with different community organizers, stakeholders in the community to figure out how equitable Tucson is as a city externally, right? And part of that, though, in order for us to serve the community externally, we do have to kind of get a house in order internally and figure out what are some of those objectives and key points that we do want to focus on. And then I think, in short, to answer your question about how do you measure equity, well, there's different fields that you can do that. But one of the things that I have brought to other organizations that I'm bringing to Tucson is the use of data, right? And the use of disaggregated data, right? And data that's not just disaggregated by race, but gender, age, sexual orientation, and et cetera, to make sure that we know who's participating in these certain programs and services. And that way we know what marginalized and underserved communities that we're missing that doesn't have the accessible access to that. So I hope that kind of answered your question a little bit. And I think I'm giving a presentation to Mayor and Council in July, so you can stay tuned to see a little bit more about that, about how I plan to implement some of this work forward.
Yeah, no, that's great. If I could just follow up, you know, this is more of a comment, my opinion, having worked on this commission for however long we've been working, is that I think one of the things that is really lacking is exactly what you're talking about. Like, what's the data? What is being done? What's not being done?
Yeah.
You know, and from the get-go, if you don't have that, it's really hard to say, well, this is how we're going to address inequities if we don't actually kind of know what they are. So I'm glad to hear that's a piece of the puzzle, because it's just hard for us to do work, in my opinion, if we don't know that. And I don't think the city has a very clear understanding of that at all. So glad to hear that that's on the agenda.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, Liz, before I call on you, I'd just like to echo Jay's comments that, you know, I'm definitely not the expert in this group on the equity issues. You know, I've heard repeatedly that some of the largest equity gaps occur around the housing issues in terms of, you know, specific races or groups not being able to get loans, even with the same financial qualifications, higher interest rates, you know, things like that. And it would be really nice to see the data if there was a way to better quantify what that is and how that impacts our community so that, you know, we can better figure out how to address it.
Absolutely.
So, okay, Liz?
Yes. So I just want to first thank Lorise. Her impact is already being felt in the city. And as she is building the foundation, one of the things she's already been meeting with all the directors, including myself and our team at HCD. One of the things we've talked about is, you know, we want to be one of the first in line to really look at the work that we're doing and how if our impact is reaching all people. And so I've offered ourselves up, especially around our funding to our nonprofits, the persons we're serving through our housing programs. We want to make sure we're looking at ourselves as, you know, objectively on this topic and righting any wrongs that we have. The other part of that, as an example, we're going through the budget process, and there's a very significant survey about asking questions about our budget and how it, again, around the topic of equity, diversity, and inclusion. So I haven't tackled that survey yet, Lorise, but it's an important exercise, and hopefully we learn something in the process of doing that. So I just wanted to share I think one of the things we know is how we spend our money and how and who has access to that money says as much about our organization as anything. So I appreciate the work that Lorise is doing already on that effort. So just wanted to share that. And again, thank you for joining us today. And this, I'm sure, won't be the only time we bring Lorise here to talk to us.
Thank you.
And Lorise, if there's, you know, opportunities as you start to vet things out in the future, if you, you know, before you want to run things through mayor and council, if you want to, especially if it's related to equity in the housing field, if you want to run them by us, please feel free to use us as a sounding board. Mm-hmm. And we'd be happy to play that role for you.
Absolutely.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, well, Lorise, thank you for being a trooper and sticking with us, even though you're feeling under the weather.
Yeah.
We appreciate it, and we look forward to further interactions.
Yes, so thank you all. And I would like to come back at another time when my voice is not raspy, but thank you, and enjoy the rest of the meeting.
Okay, take care. Okay, the next agenda item is a presentation by Fernando Moraga. Is that how you pronounce your last name, Fernando?
Yes, it is.
Fernando is going to talk about the housing support vouchers and Section 8 and what's being done to better support the landlords. So you have the floor, Fernando. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me here. Rachel's going to assist me out here because my computer is not working well with the presentation. So she's going to do this for me. Basically, what we're going to talk about today is the Housing Choice Voucher Program's landlord outreach. We've been trying to work on different items that we can help with reaching out to our landlords to assist them in many different ways that we can. Part of the agenda on our next slide is the items that we've targeted would be education, briefings, the website, marketing ideas, and then property visits. Is what we've kind of been focusing on for the last couple of months. We can go to the next slide, please, Rachel. We're targeting education for the HVC landlords. As businesses are slowly returning to normal, we're finding that many of the landlords are either new to the business or new to accepting the HVC program. As a landlord supervisor, a lot of the feedback that we're getting is that more education is needed to help with learning the program, helping out with some of the clients and the issues that they're having at their properties. And so the landlord team was created so that way we can be that support to those landlords. As a one-time call person that they can contact, a lot of the communication in the past has been that we have no one to call, or we call this person or email this person and no one is returning back. Now they have one person, which is me and my team, that we can, they can reach out to, and that we can help them in any way that we can. On our next slide, some of our issues that we're looking at is other trainings being on fair housing, property management 101, legal issues with the attorneys and with Landlord-Tenant Act, maintenance issues consisting with local contractors to help out with furthering education on the property level. We are also working on providing a handbook for resource material for the landlords that we can hand out to them when we are meeting with them, giving them a wealth of information on how to proceed on certain things. A lot of calls that I get throughout the day is, how do I do this? I'm not sure how to handle this because they're an HVC client. What is the process for this? And I think people tend to think, because they're on a subsidy program, that they needed to be treated a little bit different. The other issue is, on some of the landlords are new, completely new, that they're not aware of the legalities of certain things that they may or may be doing or what they're wanting to do. So as that being that I was a landlord for 20 years myself, I have some of that knowledge that I can help reach out to them and help move them along so that way they can proceed further and get a better understanding of what we're doing. So we want to provide some of these trainings to help them out as well, so that they know that they're not out there alone. And we know it can be kind of stressful sometimes, but we are here to help them and work with them. One of the ways that we've decided to do that on our next slide is part of the education piece is we totally revamped our landlord briefings. We have landlord briefings twice a month, every other Wednesday, that we get together and we bring as many landlords as we can, and we try to get it more interactive. The previous way of doing this in the past was more of a lecture type thing, and we wanted to get the landlords more involved so that we can teach them and show them why we have these practices and why they're useful and how they help. So we wanted it to be more, have them more participating and getting them involved when it comes to understanding the contracts, the inspections parts, the utility calculations. Examples of that being that we have pictures of a set of properties where we've been out to inspections, and we take pictures of these items that are supposedly ready for a person to move in when they're actually not. So we set these pictures out, let the landlords look at them. We have a proper discussion. Other managers kind of talk about what their company policies are to prevent some of these things from happening. And it helps them to understand what they need to do to have their unit ready for inspection when our inspectors come out there. Another issue has been the pre-calculating worksheet to determine if potential tenants are eligible for the unit. A lot of times they don't know. And so their first is, we'll call Section 8 so that Section 8 can tell you. Well, we don't have that information for what they're requiring for their property. So what we do is we have them do it with us in the briefing, so that way they can see what their qualifications are, how they are to look at the payment standard and determine if they're even eligible to even be able to live there based on their income or based on their voucher situation. And we found that that has been a big help with them in understanding that process. Our next issue that we had is on the website. We have totally revamped the website over, so that way we put RTA packets on the website. If you could change the slide for me, Rachel, please. We've added the RTA packets up there with helpful bubbles in there, so that way that when people are filling them out, they can look at what areas of the contract are more important. If we could change the slide one more time. Here's an example of what we're doing, where you can see the checklist here, where it needs to be signed, what needs to be checked off. On the next slide that we have a copy of the RTA itself explaining what these things are. On the website itself, we have links to some of the HUD's regulations. So if someone has a question as to why we require that, it kind of explains it. So it's basically very user-friendly. Our next slide shows another page of that RTA process so that they can see what we need, because these are areas where we're finding some of this stuff doesn't come back correctly, which can stall the process or make the process harder to get done because we're missing information and we don't want to have to reject anything. So that is something that we've tried to do with the website. We've tried to make it much more user-friendly, and all the forms are on there. They're easily to be located now, and a lot of facts and questions about the program that people may want to see. Our next slide, our next area is marketing. We have purchased marketing materials for our briefings, for the property visits. The reason is to get our name out there so that way we could have that point of contact with the landlords. These are some future things that are coming up. The little house with the inspections will be magnets that will be placed on every inspection as the inspectors go out there. That's left with the manager and the property so that if there is an issue, they have the inspections number. They have our landlord support email if they need to send something over. Other items such as the little stress houses or the pads of notepaper when we go out to meet with the property, that we have stuff that has our information there so they know who to contact at all times. Next slide, please. Next item is the property visits. We have been going to meet with landlords and creating that personal touch to be able to do many trainings, address issues and concerns. It also gives us a chance to work to meet the office staff that we're working with over the phone and build those relationships and create a better working relationship. When we have gone out there to meet with them, if there's any issues out there, I have my laptop with me. I can fix any issues that are there. Some of the things in just explaining what is going on helps to them if they're missing a payment or why they didn't get paid for something. And we can explain and say, this is what's going on. This is what we're showing. And we show them. And we found that it's worked a lot better and it's created a better understanding for us when we're dealing with the landlords. And they're opening up and saying, okay, well, this is what my concern is. And I'm able to address those concerns personally. And they know that we have that personal connection. It's easier as time goes forward, as we having other clients there, that we can work together and make sure that it doesn't become an issue, that we're here to help. We're not here to make things difficult. We're here to get things done. We know there were problems in the past. We've corrected those problems. This is our way of moving forward. And I think it's been very beneficial for that. And that's kind of where we're at right now. We're looking at future areas where we'll be trying to highlight properties that are working with the program, such as a newsletter that we can put out in the lobby so that people can see when they're looking for places to go, what properties are taking the program, what kind of reasons why we're highlighting those properties are some ideas that we have. We're always open to other ideas for anyone that's wishing to make a suggestion on things that would work that they think would help. We're trying just to get out there and just make it easier and just be that friendly group of people that we are to work well with everybody. Does anyone have any questions on anything?
Michael.
Thanks, Jim. Let's see, maybe a couple of quick ones. It is the duty of the landlord to commit to complete the RTA, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, just checking, because I had a chance to look at that form. How many agents, if you will, do you have on your landlord team currently?
I have four. I have one that handles all rent increases for the city of Tucson. I have two that process the RTAs. And then I have myself and another one who handles the regular specialty contracts and regular Section 8 contracts.
How many are you hoping to have on your entire team in the future?
I'm hoping to extend it at least by one more, possibly two. That's where we're at right now. One more would definitely be helpful because the contracts do come in very fast. I'm pretty fast at getting them done. We're averaging on a 14-to-9-day turnaround with the contracts. We want to keep it that way. So I'm hoping to get another person on to help me out with that.
Okay. And one last question. You said that, I think I heard you say you meet monthly with landlords.
Yes, we go out several times a month to meet with landlords. I start out with any landlords that are having some issues, whether it's RTA issues or inspection issues first. And then from there, just kind of branching out, just meeting everyone that we work with so that they know who I am and they know who my team is. I take different members of my team with me so they can meet. And then at the briefings, all my team is there so they can meet everybody and put a face to the voice that they're working with every day and be able to ask that person questions.
Okay. Thank you, Jim.
Liz?
Thank you so much for this presentation, Fernando. I think that I worked with you when you were an inspector, but I might be wrong about that. So I am curious whether you have a number of the amount of units, or not amount of units, amount of landlords that you're actively engaging with.
I don't have an accurate number of how many. We have currently 1,800 landlords that participate on the program. 1,820, I believe, was the last number that we had. The ones that I deal with primarily are going to be our private landlords, because those are the ones that usually require more help. But we do have the bigger communities that I work with also as well, you know, Notting Hill, Overlook at Pantano, some of our bigger ones that house a lot more of our people. And I work with them regularly as well.
When you came on to this position, did anyone kind of have, or did you have an awareness of beforehand of the challenges that people with vouchers face when it comes to engaging with landlords? And like, were any specific issues identified regarding landlord retention?
When I first started, we weren't in the housing crisis that we were in now. I was very much aware. Most of the landlords that are out there have worked with me in some capacity, whether it was as a colleague or where I was an area manager or supervisor for that area, that team, or a trainer. So I worked with most of them. So I was aware of what's going on at each property and knowing about the properties. Coming into here, it was different learning to find out what processes we do here to try to speed things up to make it quicker, because at that time, things were tend to be a little bit slower. And so I knew those challenges. And so I think we've overcome a lot of those where there was no landlord team when we first started. And this has been in the last 2 years, we've made a lot of changes and made a lot of strides with it. And I think it's made a big difference.
And I just have one more question. You mentioned that landlords have requested some information sessions. Have you scheduled any in the future, or is this something that you're still developing?
We're still developing. I'm working with making sure we have the guest speakers and the contractors that are able to come out. You know, I try to speak to the landlords to find out what areas of training they're looking for, and then trying to get those resources together so that way we can plan like a fair of some kind and invite the landlords so they can come and get a chance to speak with these people individually and talk to them, especially the legal aspect. There's a lot of issues that come up where some landlords may be questionable what sometimes they want to do. And so I try to advise them, you know, to seek an attorney before they make a decision. And sometimes, you know, they do things that we need to educate them on it. That was not the right way to do it. And so I think having an attorney to speak with, I think will definitely also help. So it's just getting the proper resources in. So we're developing that at the moment.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Maria? Oh, you're on mute now.
I was just wondering, so how many vouchers are there? Because there's different types of voucher programs, right? Or different types of vouchers, like there's housing choice versus, or project-based versus housing choice, right? Mm-hmm. I forget what the names of the programs are. But with your program where it's just kind of open to any landlord, how many vouchers are available? And is there like, yeah, what is the shortage? Is there still a big shortage and need?
So do you mind if I take this one?
That's fine. Go ahead, Liz.
So we have a certain number of vouchers that are authorized by HUD. So we have it between us and the county, because we administer it on behalf of the county, it's around 5,300. The number of vouchers actually utilized is much lower because of the cost of the voucher on the family. Now, we do have multiple programs. So we have our regular HCV. We have a program called Mainstream and Non-Elderly Disabled. Both of those serve those persons who have disabilities. We have the VASH program, which serves veterans. We also have the Family Unification Program for families who are in the DCS system that need housing to be reunited with their kids, and also for aged out young adults that have come out of the foster care system. So there's lots of programs. A lot of them have different requirements. We also have the emergency housing voucher program. But the one thing that's very consistent across all the programs is the difficulty in landlords using the vouchers, which we've talked about before. And so that has been driving down our utilization, because even though we have people with vouchers, it doesn't mean the vouchers are being utilized. across the board. So the search time is taking much longer. And so what we are seeing is lower utilization, not just on the vouchers because of the cost of the housing, but the inability for people to utilize their vouchers because they can't find units. Now, the majority of our vouchers, it's, I think we're somewhere around 95-96% are being utilized. But if you look over a year ago, we were above, on the funding side, we were spending all the funds we had plus what we had in our reserves, but our voucher utilization was around 95%. So, but that's dropping as far as the number of vouchers being used, but we are spending as much of the money as we can. So as the housing costs go up, so do the our housing costs, and that means less families can be served.
So you don't have an exact number as to how, I mean, do you have, does, how does that 95% needed utilization, how does that translate to how many landlords are needed? Is there?
So it's not about how many landlords are needed. It's about matching units to people, right? So if I don't have the exact number of people with active vouchers right now, but let's just suppose it's probably, and I'm trying to remember, Let me come back to you with the exact numbers. I can share an update with everyone as far as what our numbers are. We do we just did a report for the Board of Commissioners, which is mayor and council and one resident. We gave them an update, so I can probably pull that report and share that with all of you. But again, we have some landlords who have 40 people in one property, and then we have a lot of one landlords with one participant. So it varies depending on the type of unit, whether or not they're willing to accept. We have some landlords that will say, we'll take 6% of our units and use that for Section 8, which is better than a landlord saying they're not working with us, right? So, you know, we're just constantly trying to engage landlords, which I will say Fernando has done an incredible job. We had an incentive program. We did run out of funds. We're still trying to figure out if we can implement another incentive program. We have to find a funding source for that. But it's the continual engagement to convince landlords who haven't worked with us to work with us or return to work with us. Some of them did in the past and haven't recently. So the other issue is just the rents are above. Many of them are higher than what our payment standards are. So that's the other impact. Even with landlords who are willing to work with us, some of them won't accept a lower rent.
Okay, thank you. You answered all my questions. I was going to ask about the incentive program as well. And so, all right, great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So, Mark, before I call on you, I'm just going to dovetail off of this discussion. So back when we were having the source of income discrimination conversations, there was a number, and I don't remember the exact number, but I think it was like something close to like 800 housing, Section 8 housing vouchers that were allocated to individuals who could not find a place to accept them. And so is that number going up or down? Is it getting better or worse? How's that trending?
So I'll defer to Fernando to see if he's seen an uptick. I don't think we've seen any significant progress. And I don't know. I mean, for a long time, we were seeing landlords drop off every week. We were getting notice of another landlord that was not going to continue working with us. But Fernando, this is more your gut feeling versus actual numbers. What's your feeling on that?
My feeling, from what I can see and what I've talked to, is that it's getting worse for them. There's a lot of people that want, a lot of managers want to help, and they keep telling me that they want to work with the program, but because the ownership doesn't want to work with the program because they're using it as a flip property. So they feel that it diminishes. They don't want to start accepting it. The ones that do, they've lowered their percentage from 6% to 2% that they're going to work with. So we're running into those kind of issues. So I don't think it's helping because none of them, they want to, it's just where their rents are outpricing what our vouchers we can afford.
Yeah. Well, I know it's not much consolation, but I do think you guys are going about this the right way by talking to the landlords and working with them. You know, back when we were having that source of income discrimination conversation, I reached out to several managers to get their thoughts on what the issues were and why, you know, they were, why people were moving away. And the three kind of most common points of feedback I got were the length of time that it takes to get a person approved means that a unit could stay vacant for 30 to 60 days. So they can't collect rent for that period of time. The gap that you talked about between what the market rents are and what the Section 8 vouchers, it was another major issue. And the third was just the timing in terms of how quickly they could receive the rent payments, because a lot of times the rent payments from the voucher program were delayed. And so it sounds like your work, you know, you've done a lot to improve the timing, but I think, you know, continue to try to address those issues and is gonna help get that number down of unused vouchers. Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, Chairman, I just want to, I guess, underscore, I don't really have any questions at this point. We certainly at PCOA are hearing regularly about from folks whose landlords are declining to renew their contracts or continue to participate. It's a significant, potentially some of the worst experience we've ever had, you know, especially in age-restricted communities where they're just leaving the program. I think it is entirely market driven in terms of the amount of money that the rent structures that they think they're going to be able to get here. So I would agree. I think the city is doing a great job of responding, but I'm more pessimistic than I've ever been about the situation in this community. I've been doing this long enough. When I used to go to meetings around the country with people who would complain about the challenges of the Section 8 program, and I would say, well, we don't have any of those challenges here. The rent stuff has just really outstripped the ability of the program to fund the vouchers, I think. And I, like I said, I'm sadly...
Okay, thank you, Mark. Liz.
So I received a message from a member of the public, and I'm just going to read it as it's written, if that's all right. Does anyone have any objections to that? Okay. What is the city doing about the landlords that take money for application fees, sometimes as high as $175, knowing the clients will not qualify for the unit?
So just so you know, we advise, and Fernando, you can talk about the advice we give to clients, to our participants. So the short answer is there's nothing we can do. If a tenant is applying and that's their fees, I think part of the education is telling tenants, you know, make sure you know their criteria before you apply. So that way you have some sense if you're going to have a chance at it. So it is difficult on clients. They're definitely being hit with a lot of fees up front. So ensuring that they understand what they should be paying for and checking the tenant screening criteria, I think is their responsibility. Of course, some of them don't have a ton of ability to understand these things. So if they have case managers, a lot of the programs we're working with have some type of support partners. So making sure they understand the criteria to help the clients that they are supporting. So that's a real issue. And again, if they're submitting an application, they typically have fees and we can't stop that from happening.
I will say that one of the things that we target in the briefing is helping the landlord to help the client understand if they qualify or not. And that's part of the rent calculating that we do with them. We look at their what they're charging for utilities. We have them fill that form out so that they know what they have for each size bedroom, so that when someone comes in, before they fill out any paperwork, they can look at what their voucher is and see what their utilities are costing and saying, okay, when we add our base rent to the utilities, this is how much the rent is going to be. It is way over the voucher. At this point, you would not qualify. Therefore, they would not have to pay for anything. Sometimes we notice because of the client's background, whether it's a credit or a criminal issue, they're not aware of what's on their background. So they're saying, yes, we meet everything else. They meet the voucher. So they proceed with going with the app, with applying for them. And then during that process, they find out, oh, you've had four evictions, or you have a felony, or you have something that the property cannot work with. So by then they've already ran the process. So therefore that becomes non-refundable and they accept the money and the person's upset about it because they weren't aware. And I've tried to tell the clients ourselves, you need to make sure that you know what's on your background, you know what's on your credit, because you still have to meet those qualifications with the landlords. Just because you're on a subsidy program does not guarantee the fact that you're going to be accepted someplace. And I've tried to get that through the landlords as well when we're processing, like make sure before you take their money, you're going through this process first. And that's one of the things that we've been targeting in our briefings and when I go out to the property, so they can understand what that process is. And I think it's helping a little bit, but yeah, that was a problem that we were seeing before that I was trying to nip in the bud.
Joe?
Yeah, I'm wondering, I know there were some suggestions from C.J. Boyd from Ward 3, City Council, recently. And I remember one of them was around some kind of maybe legislation that could kind of regulate those application fees that we're talking about. Do we feel that that's something that might be productive and might be helpful in this area? And maybe the CHD could take that on, have a discussion about that, and see if that's something that could be a recommendation for mayor and council at some point?
So can you repeat just the part of what CJ... suggestions where I missed that, the main
part. Maybe somebody remembers it better than I do, but there was a concern that Ward 3 hears from lots of constituents about applying for rentals in general, not just voucher related, but that people were putting in applications for multiple apartments, and that, you know, landlords might be getting, or managers might be getting, lots of applications for apartments with the tight rental market we've got. And that there's, you know, you've got people spending hundreds of dollars in application fees for multiple apartments and not being able to find a unit, which is affecting their ability to get into a place. So I don't think there was a lot of specificity about, hey, this is what we'd like to do about it from the council side. But since that was something they were hearing, they wanted to, I feel like, run that by us a little bit to say, maybe this is something you all know about, and maybe this is something there could be a discussion about that could lead to some action. So I think that's where CJ was going.
Got it. Well, and I think what we've been hearing from the general, from everyone, all of us concerned about the rental market in general, the bottom line is anything that relates to doing any kind of ordinances or local type restrictions related to rental practices, at this time we don't have that ability on a local level to make any conditions on what landlords can do. So the question is, how can we address it if we don't have the authority from the state legislature, because we are preempted by state statute to do any kind of conditions.
Wait, I know there are certain preemptions for things at the state legislature level for sure. Are you saying there's specifically one around regulating fees for rental applications?
So it's pretty broad. So I would say it would fall under the preemptions that are currently at the state level. So there, it's not specific, but I believe if we try to make some conditions around limiting fees, I think we would find some, we would find out that being told that we can't do that.
Wow.
And I'm happy if anyone disagrees with that, but I do believe that it's pretty broad as far as what we cannot do.
Do we have an opinion from city attorney or anything like that on this?
We do not as of yet, but I will say that we could put together some strategies, and we could even, I was going to say, we're having lots of conversations with Arizona Multi-Housing. They have strong lobbyists that watch these things very closely. So as you know, the source of income ordinance is one of those things they're watching closely, because they know that we've gotten the go-ahead to move forward with that. It's not in place yet, but, that, again, is outside of the scope of the statutes we're talking about as far as rent control or doing anything that's above and beyond the Landlord-Tenant Act. So the Landlord-Tenant Act is what sets the fees, sets the rules around those things, and local jurisdictions can't add or take away from the Arizona Residential Landlord-Tenant Act.
Okay, thank you, Liz.
Okay, any other questions for Fernando or Liz?
I think I have a quick one, Jim, and we could talk about this later if need be, Liz or Fernando. That 6% figure that was mentioned, is that the figure that you request of a landlord to set aside for HCV, or how does that work?
Yeah, that's what I understand from the Arizona Multi-Housing Association, the AMA, that is some of their members. That's what they self set for themselves. That's a percentage they put within their own criteria. So I don't know how that 6% came about, but that's a number. And Fernando, I don't know if you have anything to add to that. I think I learned that through Fernando too.
Yeah. Usually what the owners will say is that because they want to be able to really fluctuate the rents around, what they would do is say, we're going to hold over, if you have a 300 unit property, we're going to hold over 6% of our units strictly for poverty or low income people. So that way the rest of it, they can make money off of the other properties or the other units in the community to offset what they can't do with these numbers. So they don't want to get it too much higher because it's going to cause an issue where they can't fluctuate the rent the way they can with a client that's not part of any kind of assisted payment status. There are other places where, depending on what the, if they're on a tax credit property or so on, then they're by law, they're required to have 22% or more of their units to make sure that they have enough for low-income housing. But a lot of those properties are now expiring in that area where they can now have more flexibility to fluctuate those rents better. So the 6% just kind of stayed with some of the properties that do not want to work any further with people anymore on that property. So that's where that kind of came from.
And I do notice, Ben, you're on here. Would you have any comments on the things we shared, Ben, since you're representing AMA? I don't want to state anything that's inaccurate.
Sorry, it took me a while to get unmuted because I usually don't speak. Thanks, Liz. It really is, it's market driven and it's completely voluntarily right now. And that's why our organization has been working with Liz and her staff to talk to these landlords and get more of them to get engaged in the program, with the idea that a lot of the issues that Jim had mentioned in the past and some of the other, there's a lot of perceptions out there that I'll say are holdovers from the previous administration that are no longer accurate. So we've been working with listener staff. And I'll tell you, I did attend the briefing recently that Fernando put on, and those the pictures of the failed inspections were, I would say they would be comical if they weren't so tragic. So definitely, yeah. So long story short, to answer your question, it is currently all voluntarily, and it's really market driven, depending on the size and the ability of each individual property.
Great. Thanks, Ben. Again, Ben has been a great partner. He has been coordinating meetings and stuff. And again, I think there is an appetite for properties to work with us. The question is, how do we find some compromise on doing that? But, you know, the market is where it's at today. And because of the work Fernando's doing, we're finding some positive, relationship building. But, you know, the larger market issues, I think, are what's really impacting us and our ability to fully utilize the vouchers.
Okay. Any other questions on this housing voucher discussion before we move to the next item? Okay, hearing none, next agenda item, we're actually gonna skip down to agenda item number 8, which is the HCD updates. And I think Liz has some exciting news to share.
Yeah. So June 1st, yesterday, Arizona Department of Housing announced their record-breaking tax credit funding. And we had submitted an application for a project called Milagro on Oracle. I think we gave you all an update on what that application was, and it was funded. So we are very, very happy. It wasn't funded through the normal process because the way it was scored and where we laid on the list, we probably would not have been funded had it not been under the category of unique opportunity, which was at the discretion of the director of Arizona Department of Housing to pick a project outside of the normal ranking and selection criteria. So we were very fortunate to have been selected under that category. Sadly, there was two projects for Tucson. We were the only ones, again, because of the scoring and the way it worked out. The other project was La Frontera's Sleepy Hollow. So unfortunately, only one project out of Tucson. Again, if they didn't have that category, it would have been a zero for Tucson. So we're very, very grateful. And now some of the hard work has to happen to make sure it's completed. So there's a lot of things that have to happen between now and the next year. But I want to give a ton of thanks to Ann and Sarah. And we brought on a consultant, David Wohl, to put our application together. And there was many people who helped us, many, many people. And so I just want to say thank you for everyone's support on this. I think this helps show our commitment to trying to do the work that we talked about in the Housing Affordability Strategy Plan for Tucson, that we are going to take aggressive steps with our city-owned parcels to work with our bring on co-developers to help us get more units online. So that's one of our great updates. Any questions on that? I see Jay has his hand up, Jim.
Go ahead, Jay.
First of all, great work. Congratulations. Nice job. I know that you guys really worked hard to pull that together, really kind of pulled a rabbit out of a hat. So kudos to y'all. I really appreciate that. My question is, what do you know why La Frontera's project didn't get funded? Like, what is it about the QAP or, you know, the scoring and whatnot that made it so they didn't get funded?
So I'll give you my thoughts, but I think Jim and Sarah, anyone else who wants to jump in, who understands this better. So when, and I don't remember what month, but they put the self scores out. So for example, we had 175 La Frontera had 175. Several projects had 175. There's things called tiebreakers that would help differentiate. So under a tiebreaker, La Frontera would do better than us because they had more units. But there was probably some other tiebreakers that put La Frontera under the funding line. So they could only fund certain number of projects. They had some set asides, some things that some projects got funded. But it was part of the issue is, as an example, where La Frontera and our project both lost points was that those projects were in the 85205 zip code. And because that zip code was had previous LIHTC projects, we could not take those points because it was in that zip code. Had it been in another zip code, our projects would have scored better and possibly been funded under that criteria. Jim, would you add anything to that?
No, well, I think just in general terms, there were 33 projects submitted for tax credits in the state, which was, I think, a record. It was a lot more than I anticipated because this year they completely revamped the QAP and the scoring criteria for how projects are evaluated. So nobody really knew going in what was going to be a winning project and what wasn't because there was no baseline established. So I think that in and of itself created a lot of uncertainty. There was, if you add up all of the tax credits requested of the 33, there was about $63.8 million of tax credits requested. The allocation to our state was $29 million. So 16 projects received an award. So it was almost 50% of the projects received an award statewide. And it's just based off of the scoring. And I agree with Liz that having the 85705 zip code basically there was a scoring criteria where you get 10 points if you're not in one of the following zip codes that was listed. And they came up with that because they're trying to get the tax credits kind of spread across the state where if there's a concentration of projects in one zip code, they want to try to get them out to other zip codes. That was the reason that they put that scoring criteria in place. But when you have something like the city trying to focus on a specific zip code, I'm not sure that makes sense. I did talk to Ruby and some others at ADOH about that. I think we talked about that briefly when Ruby presented 2 months ago, actually here, about getting that zip code off of the off of that list. And so that should help us going forward. They said they can make minor modifications to the QAP for next year, but they're not going to be making a lot of major ones. So if there's things like that we can do that are going to help, really what we need to be focused on for next year is getting the number of submittals up. You know, I'd like to see 4 or 5 submittals in Tucson in next year's list. If that happens, then we should receive at least 2, maybe 3 awards.
And I did see Ann's here, and since Ann, did you have anything to add to that?
No, you all said exactly what I was thinking. So you covered that all. I'm doing a little bit of math to see the percentage of our population but how many tax credits, what we received in proportion to our population. I was at a training last week about tax credits and some other things and found out that a lot of states in the country do more of a geographic proportionality. And so that was just something that caught my eye given the discussion that we keep having on this.
The one thing I would add is that we have an opportunity in August to give feedback on the QAP. And what I'd like to do is lead a discussion that the mayor already has a roundtable for us to try to pull our comments together, have a kind of a unified response to the state on those. So that's something I'm going to see if we can get organized in July. June or July, so we can get our thoughts together.
Did I was just going to ask, the rest of the tax credits, did they go to Phoenix?
Phoenix got a lot. I can just run down the list real quick. So let's see, Maricopa, Surprise got one, Phoenix got one, two, three, four. Actually, Phoenix got only four. There were two tribal projects. One of them was the Pasco Yaqui, which is here in Pima County. The other one is a Halalupai. There was a lot of rural projects. So rural projects have been very difficult to get awards on. In fact, the last couple of years, there was only three rural projects. So we saw a lot more of that this year. Prescott Valley got one, Globe, Page, Miami, Cottonwood. I think I got that wrong. Bullhead City. Miami did not get an award, but Huachuca City and also got an award. So Phoenix received 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 awards, and Surprise received one. So what's interesting is like Mesa, Chandler, Glendale, Tempe, none of those cities received awards either this year.
The last thing I wanted to say is I understand the complications of not allowing or not giving points because projects are going to be cited in zip codes that already have projects. But, you know, the city of Dallas got sued because they put all of their tax credit and other kind of affordable housing projects in low-income zip codes that happen to be majority Black. So, you know, there is a real reason for not concentrating low-income housing tax credit and affordable housing in certain zip codes. So from a fair housing perspective, I understand there's a reason for that. I also understand the difficulty it creates. But, you know, if we're going to make our society more equal and address the racial issues of the past, those are some of the obstacles we've got to figure out how to deal with. So just another thought there.
Just a few more updates, Jim, if there's no other questions. This coming Tuesday, we have mayor and council. So for study session, we will be talking about the Thrive expansion, which where you, city mayor and council had committed funds out of the local American Rescue Plan funds to replicate what we're doing with our choice area, the Thrive in the 05. And so we're going to be presenting three potential areas. We are recommending one based on various factors, but I invite all of you to hear that discussion this coming Tuesday. The other item that will be in the regular meeting is our first for-profit developer has submitted an application for impact fee waiver. As you all know, you were very important in helping us get the ordinance changed to expand it from just nonprofit, but to for-profit affordable housing developers. So that is that project will be Newport at the Rodeo. And so that project is slated to go to council for approval of the impact fee waiver. And then finally, I wanted to share, and Shane could probably speak to this better than I, the IDA kicked off the essential workers funding program to expand housing. And so that I'm thinking maybe we want to bring Dre Thompson over to speak to us about that and what other things the IDA is working on. So Shay, I don't know if you would want to add anything to that, since you're on the board.
Yeah, that's a really exciting board. We have an all-woman board. It's a bunch of really powerful ladies here in Tucson. So it's been awesome to learn from them. And Dre's been awesome helping us move forward and get some programming started and funded. And so it's been really good. That fund is, you know, we're a public finance entity, so we issue different types of mortgage certificates and different types of, manage different mortgage programs. One of them is the Pathways to Purchase program. So So we've helped out a ton of first-time homebuyers, and this is just another first-time homebuyer program that's specifically geared towards essential workers. So yeah, it's really exciting.
Thank you. And so that's my update, unless there's any other questions, Jim. Thank you.
So just to put Corin on the spot here, but there is one other thing I think it'd be good to bring everybody up to speed on, and that is the Mayor and Council directed development services to look at a parking waiver for affordable housing and EV requirements on different types of projects. So Corin, I don't know if you want to just give a 2-minute update on that.
Sure. This went to Mayor and Council actually last month in April, and there was a public hearing, and at that time they requested some additional outreach and engagement, so that, you know, we made sure that all voices were kind of part of the process, and just to have a little more discussion about how this would work, because there's two components of this proposed parking change. One would require EV chargers at new commercial development that includes multifamily, as well as, you know, retail and office uses. The other component is to expand the use of the individual parking plan, which is basically a parking flexibility tool. It's a way for developments to request a reduction in their required parking. And right now, bars and restaurants are excluded, and also affordable housing is not one of the eligible uses. So the proposal is to make affordable housing eligible to use this tool so that parking can be reduced. And this is on a case-by-case basis. So any development or site has to apply individually. It's not an across-the-board parking reduction. But affordable housing could then apply, and then also it would be expanded to allow bars and restaurants to use this, and that's kind of in response to some of what we saw during COVID and the use of outdoor seating by restaurants would allow them to convert some area, some of their parking area to outdoor seating. So obviously the relevant pieces for you all, I think, are just the expanded use of the individual parking plan, which again, I think that would be really helpful for affordable housing developments. Right now, affordable housing developments can utilize it if they are close to transit and need some other things, but this would just mean that any affordable housing development could use this, you know, whether or not they meet some of the other criteria. So it just makes it a more usable option for affordable housing if they do want to reduce the required on-site parking. And then, of course, there's also this EV requirement, and that's something we heard a lot about from multifamily developers and just other commercial developers, and we're, you know, looking at how to craft that requirement so that it is, you know, doesn't add to our housing costs, but also is a way of providing this infrastructure that is really growing very rapidly in terms of the need for EV infrastructure. So that's what we are working on with this parking code amendment. We held these a series of meetings, as Jim said, last week, and got a lot of additional input and great feedback. So we're working on some tweaks that we're aiming to get this back to Mayor and Council July 12th. That's still tentative, but that's what we're aiming for. Once that date is set, I will let you all know that that is scheduled for Mayor and Council agenda, and that would be a public hearing on July 12th.
Okay, great.
And
thank you.
Happy to answer any questions.
Thanks for letting me put you on the spot there. Okay.
Anytime.
In the interest of time, let's move on. We've got two more agenda items. So next agenda item is agenda item number 6, the subcommittee updates. First is the housing segregation subcommittee. So Jay, you've got the floor.
Thanks, Jim. We had a meeting scheduled last week or the week before, but our agenda was not posted in time. So we were faced with postponing or just canceling. And we canceled because basically a couple of months ago, we brought forth to the full commission the idea of creating an equity study or something like that to establish a baseline And this is the second meeting in a row in which that discussion that we as a commission decided to have has not been agendized. I noticed it was not on the agenda and asked staff to put it on the agenda this time. It still didn't happen. So I'm a little bit frustrated by that because that's what we're supposed to be talking about. So hopefully it gets on the agenda for next time. I'm also going to take this time to reflect on what Joe said. I have to be honest, as a commission, I think we're not really focusing in very much on equity at all. We are not talking about displacement. We're not talking about gentrification. Again, the segregation subcommittee has brought this issue to the table, and it's still, we can't seem to even discuss it as a full commission. So I have to say, I'm still a little bit frustrated. I think that we're spinning our wheels and we're still in, have not addressed equity outside of really affordable housing, which, don't get me wrong, is super important, but it's only one piece of the equity puzzle. So I really hope that we can get our act together and actually start looking at equity issues. Hopefully the new city department will help to spur that. We shall see. So anyway, I think we still have a lot of work to do as a commission before we can say we're doing a whole lot with equity. So that's where I will get off my soapbox for now and pass it on to the next subcommittee. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Next item, Housing First. Liz or Liz?
Thanks, Jen. I'm the chair for Housing First now. So we did have a meeting this month. We did have quorum, which is great that we have now three voting members instead of the two. And we basically, I invited a lot of people to come and attend the meeting. We're having some difficulty with people getting back, with having the agenda items in the first place, because we just haven't, we don't have like an established subcommittee in general. At this point, it's like literally Mike, Mindy, and me. So if anyone would like to be part of the subcommittee or knows of someone that would be a good fit for the subcommittee, please let me know. I contacted Community on Wheels, which is a local organization that does provide meals to people who are living on the street. Haven't heard back from them. They are pretty busy. And then Joe attended as well, and he mentioned the tenants union. So I'm going to go ahead and try and reach out to them, see if they'd like to be members. We heard from Brandy Champion, who's the director of Housing First for City of Tucson, and also Austin Puka and Jason Thorpe, who are other staff members for City of Tucson. They discussed just funding in general with us and gave us some kind of like baseline lingo. It's my goal for us to get connected to the HMIS lead or someone who does education for HMIS for the next meeting, because I'd like for us to get educated and an update on the PIT and HIC counts, as well as what HMIS screening tools are being used for people entering housing programs.
Very good. Any questions for Liz? Okay, last but not least is the Affordable Housing Subcommittee. Shay?
Yeah, we also weren't able to make quorum this week, this past month, so we had to decline our council our meeting as well. That's no updates.
Okay. Any other questions or comments on the subcommittees?
There's one thing that I forgot to mention, which is that I have been in contact with Corin about discussing more sustainable development in Tucson. And she mentioned that that's something that the Affordable Housing Subcommittee is looking at. Is there a potential for us to have a joint meeting of some kind in the future for Corin to be the most efficient that she can? Is that something that's allowed for the subcommittee?
I'm happy to jump in. My I think it would not be allowed if there's a quorum of the whole commission. So if you have, you know, if you have three, you have three, that makes six, which is then a quorum of the commission. That said, if it's something that two groups are interested in, it seems like something that maybe could agendize on the full commission meeting. One thing, Jay, I did want to say, thank you for letting us know. We're happy to agendize the equity item. I think as there's shifts in staff, we're all sort of figuring out who's doing what. And so sorry that didn't get agendized. But yeah, Liz, I would say probably best thing would be to agendize it in the full commission.
Great. Thank you so much.
And I will tell you guys, when we talk every month about the agenda, there's not been a conscious effort to exclude any things. In fact, a lot of times we're, you know, trying to figure out what to add as agenda items. So, you know, some of it lies on my shoulders as well. And, you know, I could use your guys' help in terms of you know, making sure we get those things in there that you want to have discussed. So I'm committed to make that happen as well. Okay. Our next agenda item is the communication of Mayor and Council. I'll go ahead and share my screen here. I sent each of you an email earlier today with this letter. Can you guys see it? Yes, can you get it? Okay. So I'm just going to run down this real quick, and I guess I'd like to hear comments, feedback. At the end, we'll take a vote if we're comfortable sending this or not. So we're supposed to do quarterly updates. It's been a little bit more than 6 months since our last update. So I'd like to get these going on a more regular basis, as we've talked about before. I think it'd be nice to have some face-to-face time with the members of Mayor and Council. So beginning is just a bit brief overview. And we go through the meeting schedule, the members. We do have one vacancy right now, as we talked about. Joanna Carr. We're hoping she can fill that vacancy. She's on staff for the Arizona Housing Coalition, and she recently moved to Tucson. We have our ex officio members. The topics discussed today is we reviewed and provide feedback on the HAS plan. There was an ARPA funding presentation given by HCD. We provided some feedback on the City of Tucson's home down payment assistance program. And then we reviewed and provided feedback on the affordable housing density bonus proposal. We reviewed the ETOD proposal for the North-South Transit Corridor. We have a draft of the bylaws, and I need to work on that some more and get that on our agenda going forward. But we need to get our bylaws in place for this commission. There was a presentation on waiving impact fees for affordable housing projects in Tucson. We voted unanimously to support that, and it was subsequently passed by Mayor and Council. The commission supported a recommendation to look at reducing the parking for affordable housing projects, which is now currently under consideration. We just talked about that. We added a new member, Kimbriana Washington. And we reviewed the down payment assistance and income assistance program. So those are the main topics that we've reviewed. There's actually quite a bit on here. Any comments or feedback, things we need to add or change here? Vicki?
Oh, thanks, Jim. I think it looks good. I just had one request on page 2 where it lists the ex officios. I just wondered if we could put the full name of my organization. It's actually Direct Advocacy and Resource Center. And it's instead of the word and, it's the ampersand.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks.
Beth. Any other changes to what we've gone through? Okay, so the next section we focused on the subcommittees, and I tried to summarize what each subcommittee is working on along with the chairs of the subcommittees. So the first subcommittee was affordable housing. They developed a high-level list of recommendations on actions the city can undertake to incentivize development of additional affordable housing units in Tucson. They're currently paring down the list to items which are easier to implement and will have a larger impact. So, Shay, I don't know if you've got any thoughts or changes to that, or additions.
No, not at this time. Thanks, Jim.
Okay. For Housing First, learning about other community Housing First programs, orienting on the city's Housing First programs, and then developing goals and priorities for the committee. Liz, are you any other thoughts or comments on that?
Something we discussed at the last meeting was basically having a space for the commission for us to listen to people who receive Housing First services and then basically share that information with the full commission, as well as learning about and making recommendations to Mayor and Council on rental housing specifically.
Okay, so you're taking feedback from participants. In the Housing First programs. And say the rest of that again, please.
And then maybe another bullet. Oh, I'm sorry, and sharing it with the full commission. Sharing that feedback with the full commission.
Okay. Was there another one?
Learning about and making recommendations to the commission on Tucson's rental housing.
Is that good?
Sure thing. I don't know what orientation on city's Housing First program is in reference to, so that might be able to just be covered in that first bullet point.
Okay. How's that? Okay.
Perfection. Thank you, Jim.
Okay, third is the housing segregation. Jay, we went through this before, defining and better understanding housing segregation in Tucson by analyzing analytics and identifying equity issues within our community. You good with this or any changes here?
I would say that there should be another C point that is that we suggested that a study be created or done to create an understanding of the baseline of housing equity in Tucson and have brought that to the entire commission for discussion at the hopefully the following meeting.
Just a study on establishing a baseline of housing equity in Tucson. Is that?
Yeah, that'll
captured,
work. Yeah, that'll work.
Okay. Okay. So here's the ask for Mayor and Council. We still have one vacant seat we'd like to have filled. We're recommending Joanna Carr fill that role. And we're hoping it can happen quickly. The other ask is that we would like to transfer some of the individuals who represent our nonprofits and stakeholders who are currently ex officio members and make them full voting members of CEHD. And we talked a little bit about our open meeting laws require quorum, including the subcommittee meetings. And I think having these additional members would help us meet quorum for the subcommittees. So the five individuals that we are requesting be moved from ex officio to full voting members are Maggie Amato-Tayez, Wendy Asher, Marianne Bierling, Mark Clark, and Vicky Casino. So any thoughts or questions on these items or changes? Yes,
yeah,
Betty?
This is Betty. Yeah. I don't know who Joanna Carr is. Did we discuss her previously, or do you have a resume for her that we could look at before we all agreed to that?
I don't. Liz, do you
Jim, I believe Joanna is on the Zoom call. If she it might be put on the spot. Just an FYI.
Hi. Yes. Hi, everyone. Sorry, I'm multitasking and kind of just listening into your meeting. So thank you for having me. But yes, here I am. I'm Joanna Carr. I'm the Research and Policy Director with the Arizona Housing Coalition. So I recently moved to Tucson from Phoenix, and I've been working with the coalition since 2019 now. And I have a background in direct services working for rapid rehousing programs in Maricopa County. So yeah, I'm really interested in getting to know the Tucson landscape. And my background at the coalition is in local level policy. So engaging with local municipalities, cities, towns, and counties around the state towards advancing best practices around ending homelessness and advancing affordable housing. So that's my background. Jim and Liz reached out to me about this opportunity, and I'm very excited about it. I'm just kind of listening to this conversation today. I feel like I can, I guess, bring insight from other areas of the state and some of my work around national best practices too. So anyway, any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Oh, thank you. I didn't even realize you were on the call, so but that's good. Okay, that's fine. I had actually reached out to somebody myself, so I just was wondering. I didn't know there was a process.
I'll tell you what, Betty. If maybe offline, share that. I think you know we. One of the things that. Yeah, the last thing I said here is, you know, as people want to start terming off, it would be good to have a pipeline of individuals we want to have added to the commission. My thought was that new members, we could bring them on starting as ex officio, and then as positions open within the commission, you know, it'd be easier to transfer them over. So I don't... let's talk about that offline. The other question I have, I think, Betty, you're with the South Tucson, correct?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yes, I'm the housing director for South Tucson.
Right. Okay, I knew that. so any other comments or changes requested on this last section? All right, well, hearing none, would somebody be willing to make a motion that we, based on the changes that we've discussed today, finalize this and send it to Mayor and Council?
I move to submit the modified on quarterly update to Mayor and Council.
Was that Liz Wilson?
This is Liz Wilson.
Okay, thank you, Liz. Is there a second?
This is Lori. I'll second.
Thank you, Lori. Any other comments or discussions before we put it to vote? Okay, Michael Edmonds.
Aye.
Taria Jimenez.
Aye.
Liz Wilson. Is that an aye?
Yes, sorry, aye.
Jay Young?
Aye.
Mindy Bernstein? Mindy, you still here?
Mindy wasn't here today.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. That's right. Lori Mazurbo?
Aye.
And Kimbriana Washington.
Hi.
Okay, the ayes have it. So thank you, everyone. Okay, next agenda item is to talk about agenda items for future meetings. So I know one agenda item. And that is the housing equity study. Liz, did you have something you wanted to add to the next meeting?
Yes, Liz Wilson.
Yes, Liz Wilson. I thought you said something and I didn't write it down.
I know that I think Shay and I have both been in contact with Corin. I don't know if that's accurate, I had asked for information about, let me pull that email up. Sustainable development and zoning, most specifically for low-income housing. That's what I requested.
So, yeah, just to add to that, I'm on the Affordable Housing Subcommittee, so that's really been the discussion there. There's been a lot of discussion around zoning and how zoning affects housing costs, affordable housing, as well as just housing supply in general. So there's just been a lot of discussion in the Affordable Housing Subcommittee around zoning, so I thought that it might make sense to have more of a joint conversation, or perhaps as since Anne mentioned, you know, the concerns about quorum, maybe Liz, you just want to attend one of the upcoming Affordable Housing Subcommittee meetings where this might be a topic, and bring some of that information back to the Housing First Subcommittee. That might be another option, or this could be a larger discussion at the commission.
Okay. Are you good with that, Liz?
When does the Affordable Housing Subcommittee typically meet?
Typically right before the next meeting, usually a week before, isn't it, Shay?
Yeah, we've been meeting a week before. I will say though that I what I've asked about has been more or what's been on our agenda, we've really been focused on zoning specifically. We haven't really dived too much into we've talked a little bit about like the ordinances, some of the residential, because there's like the EV charging station ordinance, there's a solar readiness, there's the gray water harvesting, like there's a ton of ordinances that have been passed on top of zoning and on top of building code. So I'm not sure exactly what you were, was there something else you had heard me mention that I just was curious what you were referencing?
Oh, no, Corin just had emailed me saying that it's zoning is being discussed in the Affordable Housing Subcommittee. So I didn't know if it was something that y'all had discussed specifically.
I mean, like not specifically on its own as a topic. And then the other thing I would say is that I've mentioned it a little bit in regards to the flexible lot development option, because that's a portion of our code that kind of outlines both affordable housing and projects that are more sustainable. It's kind of outlined in that way, but we've really been just focused on zoning.
If I could add that I would like to know if there are any projects within the city of Tucson that are currently in planning and zoning, or maybe all the way through the process, that are building subdivisions just for lease ups instead of homeownership. And if there are, or maybe even in general, what is in the pipeline for development, for housing development in within the city limits?
I don't know if I know everything, but on the multifamily side, I'm aware of probably close to 50 projects, maybe 55 projects in the pipeline in Tucson. Mm-hmm. And some of those, the single story detached rental homes like the area development's been doing a lot of them. One of them's going up by the bridges right now. So I know that there's probably three or four of those that are in the development phase right now. And then on the apartment side, I mean, there's a lot of attention right now nationally on Tucson in terms of getting more apartments here. So I've been getting average 2 to 3 calls a week about new projects.
I mean, I would think that the city planning would know what's in their pipeline as well. If we could get an update on that for the next meeting, that would be good. Mostly my concern is the single family residences that are being built for lease only. And if they have to go through a rezoning to do they have to go through a rezoning to do that? If it's for a plat that's single family, maybe it was designated for sale, but now it's been changed to rental or lease. And if they do, what can we do to prevent, or don't want to use the word prevent. This is my issue. When I investigated one development, they said that the conditions for somebody to lease those properties, they would have to earn 3 times the rent. And the lowest rent was $1,900. So somebody would have to make $5,700 a month to be able to lease these houses. And to me, that is an equity issue for one. And the fact that, you know, if there's anything in zoning that could prevent that from happening, or maybe having a percentage of them at least be, you know, at 100% or below of median income, because obviously the majority of those homes are being built for people that don't live here. And so that's leaving a lot of our people out.
So just to interject a little, yes, Betty, there's several of these build for rent developments under construction in Tucson. Often they're, you know, casitas is a term we hear a lot because they're often smaller, like townhome style. Some need rezoning, some might not. So there have been a couple of rezonings to allow build to rent development. One thing about zoning is it is neutral on, you know, ownership and the type of structure, whether it's for home ownership or rental. So that's an area that can be hard to regulate through zoning. There's, you know, maybe other ways to approach some of those issues. but zoning is meant to be kind of neutral on that aspect. But we could definitely kind of do an update on sort of what's in our pipeline in terms of permitting and how many, you know, multifamily developments we're seeing and where we're at with some of our larger, you know, subdivisions that are getting built out around Tucson. That may take a little more time for us to put that material together. So if not the next meeting, definitely we could do that maybe later on, perhaps the August meeting. We could do a larger update on just sort of what's in our, what we see in the development pipeline and some of the trends we're seeing around multifamily as well as single family and some of these new areas like build to rent.
Thank you, Corin. Before Liz, Sarah, you had your hand up a second ago. Are you good?
I put in the chat when the Affordable Housing Subcommittee meets. It's typically every third Wednesday of the month, but sometimes it's switched around, but that's typically when we meet.
Thank you. Liz?
So I have a personal appointment that day that's pretty long, and so I don't think I'll be able to attend the next Affordable Housing Subcommittee meeting. So if Joe or Mike want to attend, or if Corin would like to go to the Housing First Subcommittee meeting, then we will be meeting, we meet the last Wednesday of every month. So I just wanted to put that up.
Okay. All right, good. So one other question I have for the group is, I was thinking it would be nice if we could start having these meetings in person. I feel like I think that they're good the way we've got it, but there are sometimes unspoken communications that go missed when you're on a video chat like this. And so I've talked with HCD staff. They have a training room on the HCD campus, which is it's near downtown. It's just a little bit northwest of downtown, like within a mile of downtown. And we could continue to have it virtually and meet in person if you guys would like. But I'd just like to throw it out to the group and get everyone's thoughts if that's a good idea or if we want to keep it the way it is. Vicki?
I personally still need the virtual option. I am not ready to meet with people in person. My work is still not open because we work with individuals with compromised immune systems as well as some of my staff. And I am a caregiver to somebody with a compromised immune system. So I would appreciate I know that virtual is more difficult, and I would love to do in person at some point, but I personally am not ready to do that.
Okay, Mark? Oh, you're on mute.
I spent about an hour and a half talking about this just before I got in this meeting in PCOA. We're also, the numbers are not going in the right direction in terms of spread right now. There were changes in dashboards, and if you actually look at indicators, the using the old standard, the prior 2 year standards, we'd be in substantial spread at this point. I have done more in person stuff. I really like in person stuff. I think some of us have been in a county meeting, which was over at the Sentinel building, which may be what the city staff is talking about. I didn't find that hybrid to work very well there. So I'm not sure where it's a good time to be going in that direction yet.
Okay. Liz?
Just on the same page as both Mark and Vicki, I was just exposed to 7 people who tested positive for COVID this weekend alone. And I'm testing regularly, but I mean, that's the most people I've been exposed to this entire pandemic, even when I was working in direct services. And if we were to meet in person, like I would also want to be virtual, but even if I wanted to show up, I would wear a mask. And I don't know how much nonverbal communication you're going to get from me wearing a mask.
Okay. All right. So sounds like the consensus of everybody has spoken is that we want to keep it the way it is. And I'm okay with that. I just wanted to throw it out. So, okay. Any other final comments or thoughts before we adjourn? And we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone. We'll see you virtually next month.